Is Jerome Weber. He, of course, is the outgoing president of ARSC. He's also a compiler of the book A Gregorian Chant, 1991. A Gregorian Chant Discography from 1991, which was a winner of the ARSC Award for Excellence. And he's a writer on early music for a variety of publications. Jerry.
Thanks. Thanks for coming. I want to acknowledge what ARSC has given me that led up to this presentation. I know something about Gregorian chant, but everything I know about early recordings, about cylinders, about everything that happened in the 1890s, for example, I learned by coming to ARSC conferences and listening. It's more notable this year than I think in the past, is that people sit through a variety of subjects all day long, not just picking and choosing the classical or the jazz or the rock that they're interested in. If I hadn't done that myself, I wouldn't know anything about the subject. More important, when this subject of chant cylinders struck me, I wouldn't have known and possibly wouldn't have cared how important the subject was. A deep bow to everybody in ARSC that gave presentations that broadened my grasp of the subject over the years. The real subject of this talk is not Gregorian chant. It's not about the revival of early music, although I'm going to have to talk about those two subjects for most of the paper to lay to lay the groundwork for my conclusion. The main point is storage and preservation of recordings and other cultural artifacts. And I'm going to describe one particular case, an irreplaceable series of recordings that has apparently been lost as the result of inadequate attention to careful storage and preservation, not to mention the lack of appreciation of its lasting worth. I'll come back to all those points in my final paragraph, and you'll see why I say those things. The earliest recordings of Gregorian chant that I listed in my 1990 discography were 30 discs made by W. Sinclair Darby for the Gramophone and Typewriter Company in Rome in April 1904, the middle of the month of April 1904, during the Gregorian Congress. These recordings remained in the HMV and Victor catalogs, at least some of them did, for over 20 years. And they were reissued on LP as a set privately in 1982. I did not realize until this year, a few months ago, that a much more extensive series of recordings preceded that set by more than 4 years. Of the five choir directors that Sinclair Darby enlisted to direct his chant records, the one who concerns us here was Dom Joseph Potier, seen on the screen. Nice man. He lived to be 88. He was born in 1835, the same year as Camille Saint-Saëns. He was the first monk to direct the research into medieval chant at the Abbey of Salem, starting in the 1850s. He published his theoretical treatise, The Gregorian Melodies, in 1880, and edited the Complete Chants of the Mass in 1883. The Liber Gradualis. By 1895, he had edited four other books of chants published by the monks of Salem. But in 1893, Dom Potier was sent away from Salem. First, he was made prior of Ligugé, a daughter monastery in the Loire Valley, not awfully far away from Salem. And then, 2 years later, to reopen another monastery. The process in the 19th century, as monastic life recovered from the French Revolution, was to reopen these empty shells of buildings that were standing out in the fields. In 1898, he became abbot of this second one, the one that he reopened, the ancient Fontenelle in Normandy, now named Saint-Vendry after its 7th century founder. I saw his skull in the chapel of Saint-Vendry, a relic. It was, this monastery was west of Rouen, about 2 hours from Paris by train. Meanwhile, the 1890s witnessed extensive debate about the merits of the solemn research into medieval chant. One of many musicians who promoted the work of the solemn monks was Charles Bourd. In March 1890, Bourd became organist and choir director at Saint-Gervais in Paris, the church right behind the Hôtel de Ville, in right downtown, where 6 members of the Couperin family had been organists over a span of 175 years. There, his Bourd's choir sang long-forgotten music of the Renaissance, Palestrina, things like that. In 1892, he formed the nucleus of his choir into a professional chorus that toured France and neighboring countries, England, Austria, the Low Countries, Italy. In 1894, two more years later, Bourd joined the composers Vincent Dandy and Alexandre Guillemont in forming the Schola Cantorum of Paris, a teaching institution to promote the revival of early music. Soon, there were Schola Cantorum institutes set up in several other cities. The monthly bulletin of this organization, La Tribune de Saint-Gervais, was established at once, and the school opened with a couple of dozen pupils in 1896. This is a title page of La Tribune de Saint-Gervais. It's called a monthly bulletin of the Schola Cantorum, founded to encourage the execution of plain chant according to the Gregorian tradition, restoration to honor of Palestrinian music, the creation of modern religious music, and the improvement of the repertoire of organists. They had, propagation was the word they used most often. Not merely education, but promotion, propagation. So these are a few of the people who will figure in the rest of the story. Now, in 1994, Gilbert Humbert, who lives in the south of France, a little place called Fiveaux, north of Marseille, published a panorama of Pathé cylinders and early discs. It was nominated for an Arsc Award for Excellence last year, didn't win, and a copy came into my hands as a member of the committee, ex officio. I discovered a footnote to the preface, in which Humbert states, "We merely mention a quantity of recordings for liturgical use published in 1900, which do not enter the numerical limits of our panorama, but which remain to be discovered in some rectory attic." There's warning, storage and preservation. What are you going to find in an attic? They were directed by Charles Bourd. That's the end of the footnote. So, of course, I wrote to Humbert about this footnote. He immediately sent me copies of several pages from a Pathé catalog. Oh, dear, do I have them out of order? Yeah. There. You're not supposed to read them. I'm just trying to show you that I got it. Under other circumstances, this would have been a handout, but I gave a lecture last week on a much broader subject, and this was one of the slides. These were slides that I used last week. Pages 37 to 40, as you can see on the screen, list... Believe me! List 215 cylinders in the series 19,000. The first number is 19,001, and as you know, Pathé skipped blocks of numbers. The last number at the bottom of the page, they're in order, is 19,429. 215 cylinders. The contents, those are... The contents are identified adequately enough that I was able to methodically go through the four pages and construct an index of 480 pieces of chant, all, as you'll see, all recorded in a short space of time. In my book, the largest collection of chant by a single group was the Salem monks' own recordings between 1930 and 1990, let's say 88. Salem monks only recorded about 1,000 pieces of chant, and some of those were two or three versions of the same piece. 480 pieces all at once. Now, more than that, they comprise a systematic survey of the ordinary of the Mass, the proper of the Mass, the major, a dozen major feasts of the temporal cycle, like Christmas and Easter and Pentecost, of the sanctoral cycle, the big saints, all the commons of the saints. Those are masses that are used for any class of confessors or virgins or bishops. As well, in addition to all those mass chants, the antiphons for Vespers, six antiphons for Vespers of each of those offices. Remarkably systematic. Umber later advised me that there's also at the bottom the an additional group of miscellaneous chants. Umber later advised me by letter that the contents of the undated catalog fall between the contents of the catalogs of 19.1 and 19.3, which he also possesses, and so it's undoubtedly from the year 19.2. Such an extensive survey of chant is not to be found on records until the stereo era. On the preceding page of the catalog, which I left out because of the four-square format, there are two testimonials. By the way, I have all this material here if you want to see it. One of the testimonials is signed, the longer one is signed, DGG, Precentor of Saint-Vendrille, the monastery of which Dompotier was abbot. He writes, quote, "I do not consider the phonograph only as an amusing object, but also and above all as a useful instrument, especially in the part that interests me," end quote. He goes on to tell how much better he can explain the correct execution of a chant by supplying a recording on cylinder than by trying to describe it in words. The other testimonial, the short one, is signed Amédée Gastouet of the Schola Cantorum of Avignon in the south of France. And it's dated January 14th, 1900. Now, you know, Gastouet was a celebrated musicologist, a collaborator of Bord and the other leaders of the Schola Cantorum, and as late as 1930, he directed two 10-inch discs for French Columbia of Gregorian chant and troubadour songs, sung with a choir of the Schola Cantorum, French Columbia. He writes, quote, "I was charmed by the results given by the Pathé phonographs in the reproduction of pieces of Gregorian chant that you let me hear during my last stay in Paris. I would be obliged if you would send me your catalog and keep me informed of your repertoire." The catalog on the page before the testimonials states that all the chants were recorded at the Schola Cantorum of Paris by the Chanteur de Saint-Gervais, that's the choir mentioned, the professional choir, under the direction of Charles Bord. So I wrote to a monk whom I met at Saint-Vendrille. Just by good fortune, I went to Saint-Vendrille a year and a half ago on my last trip to France. He identified DGG as Dom Georges Guéry, who was in fact the precentor of Saint-Vendrille, just as DGG claimed to be. He was a young monk, not yet 30 years old at the time. On the screen, we see Charles Bord on the left and Dom Georges Guéry on the right.
This picture is identified as Dom Joshgeri in the robes and baton of a precentor. Never saw that. I never saw that myself. There's more. More recently, in 1984, as I heard from my friend, my acquaintance at the monastery, in 1984, the monastery's own bulletin, La Revue de Saint-Vendry, published The Life of Dom Potier by Dom David, posthumously, because Dom David died in 1956. Dom Lucien David was Dom Potier's disciple and the choir master at Saint-Vendry for decades. And he made a set of chant recordings for Studio SM as late as 1952, shortly before his death. Steve Smolian gave me the set of 678s that I'm referring to. Whoa. For free. They were widely available in a pirate issue on period from the very earliest days, from 1952, and then, when period was absorbed, they appeared on the Everest label. The pressings were terrible, and they're still available on pirate CDs to this day, along with three other LPs drawn from Studio SM 78s. In this article, the article in The Life of Dom Potier by Dom David, we read this account of the events. Quote, "For the cylinder recording, Charles Bord did not have a worthy soloist for the Gregorian chant. He asked Dom Potier to send him his first cantor for a week. Dom Guéry then went to Paris at the end of 1899, where he was a wonder, so good that he was recalled for another sojourn. He was given 60 francs for the first 30 pieces recorded." I have a hunch he means the first 30 cylinders. In February 1900, just a couple months later, the monthly bulletin of the Schola Cantorum La Tribune de Saint-Gervais, which I just showed you, didn't I, ran an article signed Jean de Murie. That's a pen name. I don't know who it refers to. On the subject of these recordings. The title is The Scientific Discoveries, meaning recording, phonograph recording. Scientific discoveries and their mechanical application at the service of the propagation of religious chant. Nice article. The monk sent me that too. In February 1900, here it reads this way. Quote, "One day, an employee of the House of Pathé came to the Schola to solicit the recording on the company's cylinders of several examples of Gregorian melodies after the method of Dom Potier. The strangeness of the request stimulated our curiosity and suggested the application of this project to the propagation of Gregorian chant. The first cylinders that were completed were so startling in their accuracy that we did not hesitate to advise the Pathé firm strongly that a whole catalog of Gregorian chants be created for the use of country pastors, seminaries, and religious communities." The notion of country pastors being at a disadvantage recurs in this literature a great deal. The idea was audacious. I do not know if the Pathé firm had dreamt at first of the instructional application of their invention, or Edison's invention. But at least it welcomed it with such good grace that in some weeks, a whole catalog was established and a veritable library was constituted. We will not reveal the beginning of the auditions, nor the name of the precentors, plural, who took part. They are counted among the leaders, and a practiced ear can easily recognize them. Have you heard that before? The present result is that a catalog already very complete is going to be put into circulation, end quote. There's more in the article. He goes on to say that the school's purpose was to promote the correct method of singing the chants. The students would learn by ear, just as the chants had been taught 1,000 years ago, before notation was even invented. So, summarize, it's clear that some recordings of chant were in fact made in at least two groups of sessions at the end of 1899, that they had been announced by February 1900, and that the Pathé catalog 2 years later still listed them. Although this was my introduction to the Pathé chant cylinders, I now found myself working backwards through citations that I'd overlooked. In 1988, Harry Haskell published The Early Music Revival, A History. It was sitting right on my bookshelf. He wrote, quote, "The Pathé Company approached Bord in 1900 with a plan to record a selection of Gregorian chant." He must have given the proposal serious consideration, for Pathé got as far as preparing a catalog, though no cylinders seem to have been made. Now, his source, his basis for these statements, was given in a footnote. A doctoral dissertation by Philip Bord, a Christian brother, at the Catholic University of America in 1969. Fortunately, I was in Washington last week, so I was able to skim over it. The subject of the dissertation was Charles Bord and the Schola Cantorum of Paris. And I also found out from the librarian how this happened to come about. The professor, Bernier, who was his guide, his professor in graduate school, was a Frenchman who had been brought over in the 1920s by Justine Bayard Ward to teach at Salem, to teach at Catholic University School of Music. So clearly he came up with this notion that, why don't you write your dissertation on Charles Bord? Dowd, then, is the source of Haskell's statement about Pathé's proposal to Bord, including that date of 1900. And in his dissertation, which I looked up last week, Dowd then quotes part of this article that I just read to you. But he compounds his own confusion by quoting the line that I translated, "In some weeks a whole catalog was established and a veritable library was constituted." He translates it very badly, as "a real library was proposed." Not proposed. That's not the word. Dowd then adds, quote, "There is no other evidence in Bord's writings of this catalog of records, nor of the artists who did the performances." How does he know? Dowd cites La Tribune de Saint-Gervais in a footnote to the article, and goes on to say, "According to Gerard and Barnes, there is no record of the cylinders which Bord describes. A survey of the extant catalog," I don't know what he means by this, "now, for the years 1897 to 1905, does show no listing of pieces of Gregorian chant," end quote. But we know that Gerard and Barnes state in their preface, quote, "We have also excluded many religious or pseudo-religious records," end quote. And we know that Gerard and Barnes had access to only two early catalogs, one from 1898, one from 1899. And the latter ran up as high as 14,000 series. Remember, the chants were 19,000 series. Pathé left large gaps in all of their series. They jumped from 1,000 to the next 1,000. They would jump from 10 to 20 to 30, even if they only had 3 or 4 or 5 numbers in the decade filled in, and so on. I think you're all familiar with that. In fact, we'll come back to that. Gilbert Humbert's recent work attempted to clarify the problem of Pathé's discontinuous numerical series. Pathé discographers have been handicapped by Pathé's subsequent filling in of the numbers that were originally skipped, and by having, as Gerard and Barnes did, too few examples of Pathé catalogs to figure out how they operated. There are columns on each page, so that the numbers run down the left side, and then the first column shows you the original filling in, and then subsequent columns, 1901, 1902, 1905, 1910, show you how they not only filled in the vacant numbers but reused the others. Without a run of catalogs, you just can't figure this out. And I know myself, without my run of Schwann's, of Bielefelder's, of gramophone catalogs, it's very hard to figure out, even in modern times, to figure out reissues and that sort of thing. So we're not blaming the discographers who simply didn't have as much material as they needed. More catalogs would have made it easier to establish the chronology of recordings whose numbers bore little relation to their recording dates. So we can understand how easily Brother Philip and Mr. Haskell could be misled into thinking the chant cylinders never existed. But do they still exist? I consulted three archives in this country where significant collections of cylinders are kept: the Library of Congress, the Belfer Archive in Syracuse, and the Edison National Historic Site. I talked to each expert by phone, and this is not merely writing letters. All three have large quantities of Edison cylinders, and some on other labels as well, but each has perhaps a couple of dozen Pate cylinders in this country. The National Sound Archive in London and the Phonothèque Nationale in Paris each reported to me that they have none of the 19,000 series. I called. This was at the instigation of a magazine editor, Jim Gollin. I called Father Leonard Boyle, the American who was the prefect of the Vatican Library, and aroused his interest in the subject. I asked him, you know what a cylinder phonograph is? And he says, oh, yes, I know. So he knew what I was talking about. He said he'd never seen a cylinder phonograph in the Vatican Library. So I aroused his interest, but he never called back to say that he found any. I really think he would have called me if he had. And I think he simply didn't bother to write back. He didn't have my address. He would have had the phone. He didn't bother to call me to say that he didn't find them. I received no answer. This is the most disappointing of all. No answer to two letters that I sent to the Schola Cantorum of Paris. They might have been expected to know something about the matter. I was also disappointed that the Swedish Radio Archive, which is famous for the breadth of its collection, including cylinders, has also failed to answer two letters and also failed to respond to a phone call from Jerry Gibson, which I considered a great favor of Jerry's. We know that all cylinders made at this time, and just trying to show you what I learned from ARSC, we know that all cylinders made at this time were recorded on a metallic soap known as brown wax and duplicated by pantograph, not by molding. What about some rectory attic, as Umber put it? Everything we know about brown wax cylinders tells us that they are fragile and subject to, what is it someone told me today, yesterday, not mold, but a chemical deterioration that looks like mold. Not unlike many other sound carriers, as we just heard a minute ago, they need careful storage and handling. Unless a set of brown wax cylinders had been carefully stored under optimum conditions from the beginning, they would probably not be playable today. The fate of the Pate cylinders is related to the Schola Cantorum's original enthusiasm for using them as teaching tools in the dissemination of chant interpretation, precisely because they were seen as educational tools rather than historical or cultural witnesses. They would be used and then discarded as soon as a better recording came along. ARSC has been devoting some attention to the subject of storage and handling of sound recordings for some years now. We have been concerned, first of all, with determining the proper conditions in our own archives and libraries. Secondly, we have been interested in educating the professional community of librarians and archivists about these matters, hence our publication of articles and books, especially about problems that may not have occurred to them. Librarians whose training is in print materials. Finally, in third place, though, we ought to be concerned about raising the public consciousness so that private collectors and caretakers of small institutions become aware of the requirements for the preservation of artifacts that have or may have some future cultural or historical value. ARSC can perform a service to posterity by disseminating this information widely beyond its members. If we do not, future generations will rue the loss, as we now miss the chance, as I, at least, for one, now miss the chance that Charles Bord once recorded with the great Dom Poitiers precentor as soloist. Thank you. Yes, I thought I was leaving a lot of time for questions. I am very open to being educated on this subject. I hope that you people who know more about cylinders than I do will tell me whatever I need to know, because I'm not going to let go of this. I have not had time since January to complete this investigation, and I am not going to let go of it. Please tell me what I need to know. Kurt.
Did you check with Richard Warren?
Matter of fact, I didn't.
I
didn't think, I've been to Yale so many times, and I didn't think it was worth calling them compared to the three other institutions that I did. But I will talk to Richard. By phone.
Yeah, that's all right. And you said that you asked him about cylinder phonographs.
Yeah, took my.
Did you make it clear to him you're looking for the
cylinder? Oh, of course. I did. Yes, his precise remark was that he hadn't ever seen a phonograph in the place, but he knew I was talking about cylinder recordings. Yes. Please.
That's all. Oh, I expected this. Yeah.
Are there any more questions?
Thank you.